from KQED.
Welcome to On Common Ground, a collaboration between KQED and Spur, looking at how economic inequality threatens the social fabric of the Bay Area. On this program, we focus on housing. What happens to a society when so many people are priced out of the housing market?
There's a tremendous amount of wealth and prosperity and income being generated here in the Bay Area, and frankly, the rising tide is not lifting all boats. And access to that abundance is really limited, and far too many people is limited based on where they live, what their family's economic status might be, or something as simple as their race or ethnicity.
When you lose your middle, when you just have the very high end and the very low end, you have a divisiveness. You have an us versus them that's built in.
I'm Mina Kim. Stay tuned for On Common Ground after this news.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. My name is Holly Kernan, and I have the wonderful pleasure of being the head of editorial at KQED. Thank you for coming to the Spur Urban Center, which is a wonderful, wonderful space. So this event is part of a new series called On Common Ground from KQED. It's our live events initiative, and it's in partnership with local cultural institutions in the public interest like Spur, which, like KQED, is member-supported. So thank you to everybody who is a member. For our On Common Ground series, we're bringing people together to talk about how we face a future of economic, cultural, and environmental uncertainty. And we're asking the question, what is our shared obligation to each other? And so as part of this initiative, all year in 2020, KQED is going to be doing programs asking the central question, what does it mean to participate in a democracy? Tonight's discussion, co-presented with Spur, our partnership, is the first in a series that explores the ways that economic inequality is tearing apart the fabric of our social system in the Bay Area, in the nation. And what we're asking is, what do we do about it together? So this is the first of three public conversations about this topic, and we're going to look at economic inequality through the lens of housing, work, and education. And so tonight, we're looking at housing. And without further ado, I will turn it over to our marvelous host for the evening, Mina Kim, who is the KQED PM anchor, the evening anchor, and the host of Friday Forum. Thanks, Mina.
Thank you, Holly, and welcome everyone. I'm so excited to see you here. And it really is such an honor to serve as the moderator for this special new series with Spur, looking at economic inequality and its impact on social cohesion. I'm guessing that because the housing crisis in the Bay Area has been well known for some time, that this is probably not the first panel you've attended on the housing, probably not even the second panel, maybe not even the third panel that you've attended on the housing crisis. And it's well known to you, I'm sure at this point then, that you've heard that we have a supply problem, and this supply problem exacerbates housing costs and rents, which further drives people out of the region or into homelessness, is responsible for our very congested commutes, for environmental problems, and also, as we will learn more about tonight, the way that it wears away at our ability to engage civically. And leaders from every sector, they've created proposals, they've sponsored legislation, they have created policies to try to get at some of the key issues. They've formed coalitions. And I think the real question right now is, are the solutions that they're proposing enough? And are they working quickly enough to keep pace with the problem? Because it feels like every day there is a new headline, sometimes our own at KQED and from other news outlets that are saying that, you know, another income level can no longer afford to live in the Bay Area, or a larger percentage of the region is rent burdened. And so as that keeps climbing, do these solutions have what it takes to address those challenges? And so that's one of the things that we'll be talking about this evening. And I'd also like to know what you want to ask our panelists. So there are index cards at your seats. please write your questions down for our panelists, and you will hand those to our awesome KQED staff, who will hand them to me and will integrate them as we go along. So now it is my pleasure to introduce the panelists. It is such a pleasure to introduce them because they are people who have been working in the philanthropic, academic, and research and policy worlds, and they're here to tell us their approach, how they understand the housing crisis, and why they feel addressing it is so urgently needed for a dynamic and functioning Bay Area. Fred Blackwell is CEO of the San Francisco Foundation. It's one of the largest community foundations in the country. And before joining the foundation, he served as interim city administrator and assistant city administrator in Oakland. He was the executive director of the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency and director of the San Francisco Mayor's Office of Community Development. Fred serves on the board of Independent Sector and Northern California Grantmakers, the Bridgespan Group, and the Dean's Advisory Council for UC Berkeley's College of Environmental Design. He's a visiting professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley and the co-chair of CASA, the Committee to House the Bay Area. Welcome, Fred Blackwell.
Thank you.
And sitting next to Fred is Sarah Karlinski. She is senior advisor to the president's office at Spur. She's an expert in housing and land use policy and has worked at Spur since 2005 in many roles, including deputy director and policy director responsible for land use and housing policy in San Francisco. Prior to Spur, Sarah developed affordable housing with MidPen Housing, one of the largest nonprofit developers of affordable housing in the Bay Area. She served on the boards of Community Housing Partnerships, Transform, and Urban Ecology, among other nonprofits, and she has taught land use planning at San Francisco State University. Hello, Sarah Karlinski. And next to Sarah is Karen Chappell. She's professor and chair of city and regional planning at UC Berkeley. She co-founded the Urban Displacement Project, examining patterns of residential, commercial, and industrial displacement, as well as policy work on climate change. And she has won many awards for that work. Also on tax policy, she's won the 2017 UC Berkeley Chancellor's Award for Research in the Public Interest and a Fulbright Global Scholar Award to explore expanding the Urban Displacement Project to cities in Europe and Latin America. She's serving as the Senior Faculty Advisor in UC Berkeley's Division of Data Sciences and as a faculty affiliate of the Institute of Government Studies. Thanks for being here, Karen Chappell. So, Sarah Karlinski, I'm going to start with you, and I'd like you to ground us in an understanding of how much housing the Bay Area needed to build in the last two decades, and for whom, based on Spur's research.
Great. Well, thank you so much, and thank you all for being here on this night. I know that there's a competing Democratic debate, but ours is going to be better. It's going to be really good. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the research that we've done as part of Spur's regional strategy, which is a vision that we are creating to try to figure out what ought the Bay Area be like in the next 50 years. If we're successful with our policies, if we're able to build out the transportation that we want to see, if we're able to build the housing that we need, what would this Bay Area actually be like? So we undertook some research with the help of the Concord Group, which is a real estate economics entity, and we asked the question, we asked a couple questions, but one question we asked is, how have the incomes changed in the Bay Area over the past 20 years? And if we wanted to have retained all the people who lived in the Bay Area, the income composition of the Bay Area as it was in 1999, what would it have taken from a housing perspective? And so on the income side, we found something that was very stark, but perhaps those of us who have been here for a while would know this intuitively, which is that in 1999, the income curve, if you looked at kind of across the income spectrum, sort of low to high, it was more like a bell curve where you had people at who were low income and people who were very high income and a lot of people in the middle. That has fundamentally shifted. So when you look at it today, it's more like this, where you have some people who are low income, some people are middle income, but the high income has actually grown. And in terms of households, what that has meant is that we've seen an outflux of households earning $100,000 or below, of roughly 300,000 households with that income makeup. And we've added 600,000 households earning over $100,000. So the Bay Area, unsurprisingly, has gotten significantly wealthier. What that has meant is, if you look at kind of from a housing perspective, in terms of how much housing we've built over the same 20-year period, we were very successful in building housing at the higher end of the income spectrum, so the market rate side. So we've built roughly 300,000 units for those at the highest end. We built roughly 42,000 units of a permanently affordable subsidized housing, but we didn't build 700,000 units in the middle. So we should have built 1 million units, the majority of which would have been built in the middle. Roughly 500,000 of those would have been built for those below median income, and the remainder above median income, but yet not able to afford the market rate units. But it's an enormous gap right in the middle. And so what we're seeing is there's just a change in the economy that is sort of favoring wealthier people coming into our region, and then the squeeze of the lack of housing affordability, middle to low.
So about how many, when you look at renters, how much of that should have been rental units, and at what price point about in terms of a rent?
Oh, it's hard for me. I think what it said actually in that article that I sent you is like, it's, you know, between $2,000 and $3,000 dollars rent is roughly like the range that we're looking at, but I don't recall the exact statistic. And we didn't look at owner versus renter housing. We just looked kind of across the range and the number of units that should have been built.
Yes, and most of the units were above $3,000.
Yes,
in terms
significantly
of rental
so.
Cost. Yes, and I'm sure people in this room are probably very familiar with that degree of cost. So, Fred Blackwell, can you talk about the on-the-ground impact of these very high rents, the median rents being so much higher than most people can afford, and the increasing proportion of the Bay Area that reports that they are rent burdened, meaning that they spend 30% or more of their income on housing?
Yeah, it's a pretty stark picture on the ground, especially when you look at it through the lens of income and race. For example, we've reached the point where if you are in a household with two people earning $15 an hour, there are probably only about 5% of the census tracts in the Bay Area where you can afford to live. And afford meaning just kind of the way you described it, you know, pay less than 30% of your income on housing. What's happening is that people are paying much more than that for housing. I've seen numbers as high as people paying 70% of their income. What that brings is a very high level of housing instability for folks who are on the lower end of the economic spectrum. And I guess the most visible and distressing depiction of that can be seen in the region's homelessness issue and in the number of people who are being displaced from the places where they have lived. I've seen various numbers about this, but it seems that anywhere between 50 and 70% of the folks who are now without a home here in the Bay Area are folks who were formerly housed here in the Bay Area. And it just shows that the bottom has dropped out. And then I think the other thing that I would add to this is that women of color are particularly vulnerable. And so when we looked at the data, it was African-American and Latino women who were most likely to be in a very fragile housing situation. And so I think looking at it through the lens of both income, but also keeping track of race and gender and how people are impacted by this are important. And I think just to bring it back to the economic inequality issue, I mean, it's intuitively true. I mean, it's just we're in a state where there's a tremendous amount of wealth and prosperity and income being generated here in the Bay Area. And frankly, the rising tide is not lifting all boats. Access to that abundance is really limited. And far too many people is limited based on where they live, what their family's economic status might be, or something as simple as their race or ethnicity. From an editorial point of view, you know, I've grown up in the Bay Area. I think it's a great place. And I think there's a level of shame that I feel as a Bay Area resident that we're allowing that kind of dynamic to persist.
A level of shame in what way? When you say we're allowing, I mean, do you feel a personal degree?
Yeah, what I mean is this. You know, we here in the Bay Area have a pretty high view of ourselves. We engage in a lot of self-congratulatory activity. We consider ourselves like a dark blue region and a blue state. We consider ourselves a place that's diverse and tolerant and progressive. But if you are low income, if you are African American, Latino, Southeast Asian, Native American here in this region, that's not the way you experience this place. And I think that that's something that we need to grapple with as a community. And I often wonder how long we can continue to have the perception of ourselves be so out of line with reality.
Well, one of the examples that comes to mind from what you said earlier about the proportion of homeless people that you believe were formerly housed here in the Bay Area is that also dispels a long-held idea that San Francisco's homeless population is also a population of influx from other areas because they hear that San Francisco is very welcoming. And I think that that's an important point to underscore. The other one is about how this disproportionately affects women of color, because one of the things that I really appreciated in one of the reports that your foundation has partnered with other agencies to do was you actually really spelled out specifically why it affects women disproportionately, and the fact that they're taking on more debt, the fact that they just don't make as high wages than their male counterparts, whether males of color or white males especially, and also the health impacts on these women who tend to be the heads of their families trying to get their kids fed to school and to their jobs. Can you talk a little bit about those stressors?
Yeah, I think that you laid it out well, and I think that there are two pieces to this. One is how economic inequality impacts the housing situation and puts people who in some cases have been discriminated against or for other reasons in a fragile housing situation and in terms of what they're able to afford. But I think it's also important to look at it from the opposite point of view as well. When you're spending 60 to 70% of your housing or income on housing, what that does in terms of your ability to be economically mobile, what that does in terms of your ability, if you have entrepreneurial dreams, your ability to save in order to be able to do that, if you have dreams of putting your children on a different kind of economic trajectory that you're on by sending them to the best schools or being able to afford college, the impact on that, the impact on the ability to put good food on the table, food that's healthy and supports healthy living, it impacts that. So, I mean, the housing situation that folks are in is impacting people's ability to really live the American dream. And we kind of, the American dream is this ethos about being able to be economically mobile, and your economic situation doesn't necessarily mean that your children will be in that economic situation. But if you are so housing constrained, your ability to realize all that stuff is severely limited.
And one of the things, Karen Chappell, that you have looked at is also the impact on our ability to engage civically, to our civic capacities, I think is the way that you have put it, and that that atrophies in the face of so much economic stress and housing stress. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I think we can think about this in social terms and in cultural terms, and then also in terms of sort of basic civility. So our social fabric gets torn apart when our middle hollows out. We have a missing middle in terms of
middle class.
Mm-hmm. So if you think about how our institutions got built in this country from the time of de Tocqueville and talking about, you know, social capital voluntarism, right? A lot of that came from our middle class. in 1950s and on, the prosperity that we had in this country, the labor management social compact, the upward mobility, we built a huge middle class. That middle class was able to build a civic infrastructure in the schools, in social clubs, in bridging ties across different social classes, across different social groups. When you lose your middle, when you just have the very high end and the very low end, you have a schism, you have a bipolarity, you have a divisiveness, you have an us versus them that's built in. And my colleague John Powell has written about this in very powerful terms, talking about the loss of our bridging ties, that we can't bridge those divisions in the way that, we used to. We can't become the new us. Instead, it's us versus them.
Is that why you've said that you don't call it as much a housing crisis as an income crisis?
So the income crisis is that we don't have those industries that brought us the upward mobility that we had. The knowledge-based industries have not come with those same institutional supports that we had in the old economy. And so because of that, we don't have the income to pay for the housing. And there's one other piece of this, which is what Sarah was getting at, which is this missing middle physically, that we're building only at the very top of the market,
yes,
and at the very bottom of the market. And that means that we are fighting over that middle piece, right? So that the upper income folks, if they don't find enough new housing, they're pushing into the middle and moderate income housing, and they're displacing those families from existing housing stock.
So the missing middle in terms of actual physical
exactly.
Stock as well. Mm-hmm. So the big question now is, what do we do about this? First, as we know, the Bay Area needs an increase in its supply of new housing. And so how do we do that? I mean, we know that building is really hard. Building affordably is even harder. So where would you put your attention in terms of what needs to happen first to try to mitigate these problems? Fred Blackwell?
So I actually think that in order to understand where we need to go, we need to understand how we got here. And I think the dynamic that Karen lays out is important, that the number of jobs that are being created, the kinds of jobs that are being created, and the incomes associated with them, and what Sarah laid out in terms of the imbalance between the amount of jobs that are being created and the amount of housing that's being developed is an important issue. But it represents, how would I describe this? It represents the match that has lit the fire. But we have been dousing our housing market with gasoline for decades. And there are a few components to that. One is just frankly exclusionary land use and housing finance practices in the Bay Area. Richard Rothstein wrote the book, The Color of Law. Mm-hmm. And in that book, he lays out very succinctly how we have made decisions very deliberately that have produced segregation and limited people's housing opportunities, and that ground zero for a lot of that stuff is the Bay Area. So we've got to understand that.
And reckon with it. I feel like you and feel like we have not.
That's right.
A region.
The other thing that got us here and represents some dousing of the flames is the fragmented regional governance and land use decision-making structure here in the Bay Area. We have treated local control as a religion and allowed jurisdictions to make bad decisions around housing and land use issues without any consequence. No consequence whatsoever. And, you know, I'm not a proponent of taking away all of local control, but we have to have a real frank conversation about local control and its contribution to this problem. Third thing, we have always underfunded affordable housing production in the state of California. And then when we eliminated redevelopment, we lost $1 billion a year that was going towards affordable housing production. Now, there were a lot of things wrong with redevelopment, but we ended up throwing the baby out with the bathwater and exacerbating another problem that was there. All that together created the conditions that we are in right now, and the jobs housing imbalance just took it to a whole nother level.
You're listening to On Common Ground, Economic Inequality and Housing, a presentation of Spur and KQED. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to On Common Ground. We're talking about the economics of Bay Area housing with Sarah Karlinski of Spur, Karen Chappell of the UC Berkeley Center for Community Innovation, and Fred Blackwell of the San Francisco Foundation, who just before the break said many factors helped create the current crisis, including the end of state redevelopment funding and the imbalance between job creation and housing creation.
So what that means to me is that we need to address the regulatory environment. We need a regulatory environment here in the Bay Area that allows for housing to be produced at all levels of income in all parts of the region. San Francisco, Oakland, and Richmond, and Berkeley, and San Jose can't take on all the housing production requirements in the Bay Area. It's just not the way that it should be. The second thing that we need to do is we need to step up our investment in affordable housing production. That really needs to happen. Then the last piece I would say is that we need to invest in policies that protect tenants. I talked about the fact that the vast majority of the people who are homeless in the Bay Area are formerly housed in the Bay Area. It is exponentially easier and cheaper to keep people housed than to deal with them and try to triage them once they become homeless.
I hear you, Fred, when you talk about these as the necessary solutions. One of the key things that I heard some applause around was the fact that you feel like we need to stop treating local control, you know, like a sacred thing. But attempts to try to wrest away some of that local control have not succeeded. I mean, SB 50 is one example of that. The fact of the matter is that, yes, city officials, local officials control what gets built where, but they're also voted in by constituents who don't want to see big developments. So if they want to stay in office, they're not going to approve them. So how do we address that, Sarah Karlinski?
Wow.
Solve this
Fred
problem.
Fred got to say all the good solutions. Oh, man. Okay, no. I'm ready. I'm ready for this. So I think part of it just has to do with showing people the sum of all the decisions that have been made. I think it's possible to look at what we've wrought through the decision-making structure that we have right now and say, this is not survivable. Like, the Bay Area will not continue to be the place that many of us love if we do not address these problems. To parents, like, your kids are not going to be able to live here anymore unless we address those problems. We are on a path to hell, and we need to do something really, really different, or else this place is just not going to be the place that we know and love and dream about and care for. And I think just saying that in a way that is really stark and showing people that I know that you like your neighborhood the way it is, exactly as it is. We talked a little bit about how people have this sort of immaculate conception version of their neighborhood, like the version of it, however it was when they moved there, was like the perfect version, and like nothing should ever change. And there's real feeling behind that, but there's consequences to keeping everything exactly the same. And so what we really need is to balance some of the desires people have to have a say in what happens in their neighborhoods with the collective action problem of solving for housing. I think it's also really important to think about the reasons why people fear change. They're very different reasons. So some people might fear change because they bought into a neighborhood, they have certain property values, they want to keep it the same, they want to keep it nice. That's a set of feelings that one has to contend with. But there are also people who fear change because they feel like they are going to get displaced, and they've seen investment come into their neighborhood, and they know that it can lead to displacement. And I think kind of teasing those two things out, I frankly have less sympathy for the Athertons of the world saying we don't want housing than I do for parts of East Oakland or elsewhere, where what change means potentially something different. And there are different policy solutions that you can put forward in those different conditions. So I will say one other thing, which is a hopeful thing, which is that this round of the state legislature has gotten done more to change some of this dynamic than I've seen ever before. And part of that is like the good work that Fred and others on CASA have done. And part of that is that the state legislators from the Bay Area delegation, particularly San Francisco, have just been completely on fire. And they were forged in the fires of the San Francisco housing wars, and they're like not afraid of anything anymore. So they just went up there and they're just like, yeah, we're gonna do it. And that has just been very, very powerful to see.
So, for example, you're talking about Nancy Skinner, Senator Skinner's SB 330, which is supposed to streamline the process, or make it easier to build, fewer public hearings, fewer bureaucratic steps that you need to take to get a development off the ground, or maybe the rent cap.
And then, Scott Wiener with SB 50, he's not giving up.
Yes.
No, it's kind of... from The Princess Bride, which perhaps dates me, where they say it's mostly dead, but it's not all dead. But it's not even that. It's like still alive, which is deferred. So,
and can I just say 30 seconds related to this question as well? I think it's really important, which is sometimes the government generally and elected officials specifically have to do things and make decisions that are unpopular. That's the job. Yeah, I look at the civil rights movement. That was a tremendously powerful movement. But I think if at that time you went out and did a popular vote around whether black people should have the same rights that white people had around this country, unfortunately, I'm not sure if the majority would have said yes. But elected officials in the government stepped up and legislators stepped up against the wishes of a lot of their constituents and made that happen. Here in California, we voted against same-sex marriage. And I can name a whole lot of other things where if you just leave it up to 50% plus one to make it happen, and folks aren't willing to step out and take chances and political risk, that we wouldn't be where we are today. And this is becoming one of those issues.
I just want to jump in for one second, and I agree with all the issues of politics and perceptions, and I congratulate the state legislature. However, this is a very, very complicated set of problems, and we have a set of institutions, particularly our banks, our insurance companies, and the web of local land use regulations beyond zoning, the design regulations, the setback regulations, all the micro details, the building code, the energy efficiency code, which is for McMansions, not for ADUs. So how do we unpeel the onion?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we need to, there's so much work to be done, and we've lost in some ways, the banking and real estate and insurance industries have gotten so used to financing single-family homes in sprawl and multifamily luxury apartment buildings that they've really lost the sense of how to build in this middle, how to build these types of buildings.
Well, we have a couple of questions for the audience that I do think get granular to some degree in terms of these things. For example, this person writes, are there any good best practices for helping homeowners in areas of the city zoned for single-family dwellers open up to the possibility of rezoning for more multi-family dwellings? And kind of related to that, Rachel, a Berkeley student, writes, like everybody in the Bay Area, students are impacted by the housing crisis. How do we get our colleges and universities, particularly those like UC Berkeley, which partner with for-profit companies to build student housing, to build enough affordable housing for growing student enrollment? So Karen Chappell, do you want to take those?
Yeah, well, at Berkeley, we have a fabulous chancellor who has plans for about 10,000 units, so hopefully we will get that done, but we need to get the neighbors on board in order to build those units, so that's going to be the challenge. What I take inspiration from the city of Portland, Oregon, and what they have done in terms of densifying. So this is a city that is determined to bust open single-family zoning and do it incrementally by adding accessory dwellings, units, by adding duplexes, triplexes, by allowing two accessory dwelling units on a lot, and then suddenly you have a triplex. Mm-hmm. This is, I think, how you change perceptions. You do it gradually, you do it incrementally, and people can feel that this is not threatening me, this is not threatening my land values.
Well, and related to this, Stephen writes, how can we help SB 50, Scott Wiener's More Homes Act, get passed? Is there any hope to lessening the control of local communities on new construction? Sarah Karlinski?
So I don't know exactly what you could do. I mean, I would just call Scott Wiener's office and say, when are the hearings and can I come speak in favor of the bill? And wherever you live, you have a state assembly member and a state senator, and calling those offices and just being a squeaky wheel is one way to do that. And then organize your friends. You know, if you've got friends who feel similarly to you, making those calls actually does make a difference. They take those calls and they're tracking who's saying yes, they care about this, who's saying no, that they don't. And so that's one way to do it. You can show up at your local city council meeting or your local board of supervisors meetings. There's usually always a time at the beginning for items that are not on the calendar, and you can talk about the housing crisis and how it's impacted you and urge people to be supportive.
But we have to reach Marin, and we have to reach Southern California.
Yeah, right? Or you can take a bus, or, well, actually, you can drive up to Marin and go yell at those people, which is probably not a bad idea.
It's interesting because I think this conversation has been to some extent, a rather philosophical conversation, and some of the questions that we're getting are on that level. And I just do want to put them out to you. One of them being, is housing in a preferred area a right?
You know, I've been thinking about this.
Sarah Karlinski.
Thank you. I've been thinking about this a lot because as part of the regional strategy, we've been thinking about how is housing, like the housing delivery system in the United States, the same as or different to other places. And I don't pretend to be an expert on this matter, but I was talking with a colleague who did a study of housing, I believe it was both in Vienna and Copenhagen, and affordable housing particularly. And I asked her kind of what are the key differences. And she named a couple. One thing she said was in those societies, they don't tolerate homelessness. They say, we don't want to have homeless people. We don't want to allow that in our society. And the other thing that they do is instead of giving, like using the tax code to give benefits to homeowners, what they do is they tax ourselves and they provide a rental subsidy to everyone who needs the rental subsidy. So the values of those places and the ways that they manifest in both taxation and how money is expended says that we value people and we value all the people enough. But we don't say poverty is something that, you know, you're bad, you caused it, you need to like work your way up by your bootstraps, you know, or whatever. They're saying, no, we don't want to live in a society that doesn't take care of people, and we want people to be housed. And if you believe that as a society, you organize yourself to do something about it. And I just think about, you know, I was born in this country and I was raised in this country, and like all of my thoughts and feelings are kind of based on that experience of like, oh, you know, you own a home and that's how you build equity and, you know, this and that. But it doesn't actually need to be that way. And I think it would behoove us to look to other places and think about what values they're manifesting and then what values we're manifesting, which does not shed a very nice light on us as a society.
I believe that it is a right. I think it's called fair housing. It's actually a law. You know, until Secretary Carson announced that he was no longer going to enforce fair housing law, it was something that could be enforced. So I think that we are, in a lot of ways, moving backwards on issues like this.
Even if some would argue that living in a preferred area is not a right, you could say that it is an obligation to make sure that we don't have preferred areas and unpreferred areas as a society.
Yes. A couple of questions here. To clarify, of course, we need a mix, but is the goal to build a majority affordable or middle-income housing into the future? And related to that, this person writes, do you believe the city should subsidize housing for middle income in San Francisco? This would be for families making up to $140,000, which in the rest of the world is rich. Few families would actually receive this given the waiting lists. Would it be better to let the market serve this AMI percentage?
So my thought about this is that the way our private market delivery system is working right now is broken. And that there are many factors that lead to us just producing at the top end. One has to do with the value of land, which stems from in part from exclusionary zoning. Part of it has to do with construction costs. Part of it has to do with the fees and taxes that are placed on housing. And just the entire kind of cost structure of housing pushes towards luxury units. And that if there is a way of fundamentally reworking the incentive structure for housing, we could probably build through the private market much further down the chain. That being said, we're always going to need subsidized affordable housing. And if we could, as Fred mentioned, increase the dollars for that, you could make further headway on doing from lowest income inward. So there might be a way. You might not actually get to reach the middle through just private this way and just public subsidized that way. And it's whatever that chunk in the middle is that is the real nut to crack from a public policy perspective. And that might be shallow subsidies across a number of units. It might be some other types of incentives that are needed, but it's not exactly clear to me what needs to happen right at that push point, even if you made the market work as well as it could and had enough affordable in that end.
Karen Chappell.
So if the private market is not working, we can't push it to work in this way. And if it's going to cost $800,000 to build a housing unit in San Francisco, then I think we need to think about preservation for the middle class. Mm-hmm. And we can preserve a unit for $400,000. So then you start to get something that's viable financially to subsidize.
And are the regional coalitions that have sprouted up to address this issue, CASA being one of them that you're on, Fred Blackwell, are these the kinds of things that they're talking about? And is the fact that it's a regional entity helping to have local entities kind of see what sacrifices they might need to make for the greater regional good?
Yeah. So these are exactly the kinds of conversations that took place within CASA, and very detailed conversations, actually, around all these issues. Karen's statement that she made earlier around the complexity of all this in terms of yes. building and permitting and all that kind of stuff, those were all the kind, we were way in the weeds in that kind of stuff in terms of trying to come up with solutions. But the other thing that was important about CASA was the composition of the coalition that ended up coming together around the solutions. You know, you said in my bio, I was the head of redevelopment in San Francisco, and I was in Oakland. I had responsibility for, I like to call it everything that people complain about in Oakland. But one of those things was land use and development stuff. And I can count on one hand, when I was in the room with other folks who had my position in the region. There are just very few regional tables that are set to talk about these things. The other thing that I can count on one hand is the number of times I walked in a room and bureaucrats, elected officials, market rate developers, affordable housing developers, environmental advocates, labor people, equity-oriented advocates were in the room together talking about what they wanted to see happen and getting over for at least a little while, their ideologies around what the solutions needed to be. And so I think the formation of a coalition of some unusual suspects is one of the things that gave the politicians in Sacramento a little bit of political cover to step out in a way that they hadn't been able to step out otherwise. I mean, what's ironic about the things that are being passed right now, whether it's SB 50, which we hope will go, or it's the renter protection and rent cap stuff, or the regional housing entity, or the good government stuff that laid out limits on the number of hearings and all that kind of stuff. These are all things that on their own have died in the past. And they've died because they've been connected to a very narrow constituency. But when folks are able to come together across these constituencies and begin to advocate for things that they don't like, because there are also things that they like that are moving through, it creates a different kind of conversation and some daylight for, I think, a better set of solutions.
Well, this is an interesting question around coalitions. This person writes, another city's factions that want to build more housing align themselves politically with developers. SF housing activists seem unwilling to make this alliance. Is this a mistake? Developers is such a broad, but...
Yeah, so, I believe pretty firmly that you both have to have folks who are willing to get in the room and negotiate, and have folks who are outside of the room and advocating to make whatever is negotiated stronger. And I think that that dynamic is kind of the way democracy works. And so I don't think that everybody has to get inside the tent. And I think that there's some value to some people being outside of the tent and holding the line on what they think the perfect solution should be. And so I don't think it's necessarily a mistake. It is a mistake if you begin to draw everybody who's inside the tent and negotiating out of the tent by labeling them as sellouts or folks who don't have the people's interest in mind, nor do I think it's a good idea to have everybody on the outside agitating.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left of this conversation, and Sarah Carlinsey, you touched on things that are giving you hope, and a lot of it happening at the state level, actually. But Karen Chappell, what would you add to that in terms of what keeps you motivated or optimistic, if you are, that the Bay Area will be both affordable and equitable in the housing arena again?
We're seeing a lot of innovation. Even just today, I was looking at a set of apps that folks are building to help homeowners build accessory dwelling units. That's the sort of meshing of tech and zoning reform is going to actually, I think, explode. And I think this is also related to the explosion of data science in the Bay Area and the growth of incredibly brilliant computer scientists, data scientists that are actually very excited about taking on social problems.
What about you, Fred?
I am always glass half full. And there are a few things that make me optimistic. One is, for a long time, my career was in local government, and I was talking about this a little bit earlier. So I was always paying attention to polls and what residents were saying. And every year in the past, there were three things that were the top three issues on people's minds at the local level. It was potholes, public safety, and schools. Those three things still come up, but they're all a distant second to housing. I think that the public will to do something about this is changing and gaining momentum, and I think that that public will is going to impact political will to move people in the right direction. So I am optimistic about that. The other thing that I am optimistic about is that, and this is a kind of reflective of one of the questions you got from a student, young people are fed up with this issue. And they are stepping up and advocating for themselves and their community in a different way. And I think that they are going to make it increasingly uncomfortable for folks who aren't making the right decisions around this stuff. And the last thing is I've spent a lot of my career in the housing arena, we didn't talk a whole lot about it tonight, but this community knows what the solutions are. Mm-hmm. And so I think that if you combine the fed upness with the momentum on the public will side, with the abundance of solutions that folks who've been working on this have, that we can actually do this. And I think I'm a part of the Bay Area, and I engage in our self-congratulatory stuff as well. I think that we are the kind of community that can figure this out, and I don't know if we don't, who will.
So that's great, and I'm so glad to hear that there seems to be a notable shift in terms of momentum, focus, people crossing silos, working together for the first time to really try to address this in a more broad thinking way. The question I have is it happening quickly enough? Mm. I mean, we have been hearing a lot about a looming recession. It's a lot of the headlines. It's in the news a great deal. And we all know how tied that is to housing. And so, Sarah Karlinski, are you worried about that? And what impact could it have on all of this momentum that we're generating that everybody is talking about?
Yeah. I think that there are challenges that come with a recession, and there are silver linings that come with a recession. And of course, the challenges are that people who bought their homes at the top of the market with very large mortgages, if their job situation becomes uncertain, they can end up in a foreclosure situation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we saw that the last time, and it's very scary, and it impacts a lot of people, particularly people who don't have very much savings, and it is certainly a concern. On the flip side, what it does is it creates, I believe, somewhat potentially an opportunity for us to have learned from the last recession and potentially do some things differently. And that could be using some of the surpluses, perhaps at the state level or elsewhere, to either help stabilize people in their current ownership position or help nonprofits buy existing housing, rental housing, and make that permanently affordable, because you won't have developers in a competitive situation, as competitive a situation as it is right now, because they need access to capital, and if they can't get capital, then they can't compete. But if there's public dollars available, then there's an opportunity to do things countercycle that could be very powerful from an affordability mm-hmm. perspective.
Karen Chappell, what do you think?
Well, we have, in the state of California, we are blessed with one of the most progressive tax structures of any state. Now, that's because we have a very high tax on the 1%, and we redistribute that. And that's how we're actually able to pass all these great housing bills right now. If there's a recession, the 1% aren't supporting us anymore, and we can't do the redistribution. So that's the piece that I'm a little bit scared about, is that the state's going to go under again. The UC system is going to be struggling again, and we'll be back rebuilding. But at least we'll be able, as Sarah says, to buy more land, and we'll have more labor free, and the labor costs will go down, and we can build more housing for less. So, again, this is a cycle.
Well, definitely something to keep an eye on. I want to thank all of you for sharing your insights and your personal connections to this issue and why it means so much to you. And I want to also thank the audience for their questions and comments as well. And this was the very first in a three-part series called On Common Ground in partnership with SPUR that explores this question of, does economic inequality threaten the social fabric of the Bay Area? And what are we going to do about it together? I hope you'll join us for the rest of this series. The next one is on October 10th. We'll look at economic inequality and the future of work with Egon Terplin, Senior Advisor to the Governor on Economic Development, Natalie Foster, Senior Fellow at the Aspen Institute's Future of Work Initiative, and Jed Kolko, Chief Economist at Indeed. And on November 14th, the third and final event in this series, will examine economic inequality and education. The tickets for that will also be kqed.org/events. And thank you so much for being here.
On Common Ground is a co-production of Spur and KQED. Our engineer is Jim Bennett, radio post-production by Nina Thorson. Ryan Davis produces KQED's live events. Our editorial team includes Vinnie Tong, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Produced by KQED.